All right. Well, today is a bit freeform, which is always dangerous. I plan to talk with you about the philosophy of discourse, and in the process, try and locate us in where we are in the flow of what I'd imagine to be the trajectory of our enterprise. I'm also eager to open up the floor to discussion about yesterday's event, which I will say something about in the course of saying something about the philosophy of discourse. And then I'd like to have time at the end to relate to podcasts and to a thought about how we might proceed. Then have the opportunity for feedback. So, kind of a lot. All right, so, in a sense, this class is about two things. It's about argument, empathic as opposed to oppositional, and it's about cyber media, projection of message out into the space. The argument part of it has classic rhetorical origins. The idea of empathic argument can be seen as not different from the idea of communicative discourse that Habermas describes, or the basic ideas that people in sales teach their salesmen about how you must relate to the person you're trying to move in a way that they can identify before they even start to listen to you. The whole experience that we go through again and again in different forms, in different places, has at least some sense of structure you can see. I think of it in terms of a law student coming to a case for the first time, the first case you ever read. You read it, you have a feeling about it. It tells a story, it relates to your emotions. You have a sense of justice or injustice in it. But without having read any other cases, you've got nothing else to relate it to. It's just the case. And you read your second case, and you make distinction. Distinction, the thing that allows you to craft categories and meanings. And you get into making distinctions. As law students, you get really good at making distinctions. You get so that you can make distinctions quick as an eye on just about anything. But the typical path is that as you become really competent at discrimination, categorization, you can lose feeling so that ultimately you just become a hired gun. Tell me which side, I'll argue it. That's kind of a step up from where you started, but in another sense, step down. But then there's a further stage that has you coming back to the subject. And you were attracted to the subject in the first place. There was something that drew you to law. Like when you come back to a glass of wine after having become a connoisseur. You can come back to it and appreciate what it is, but now in the context of all you know. At that point, you're a good lawyer. You have feeling, and you have knowledge, and you're able to put the two together. And then you can move on to yet a further stage of becoming a creative figure in that environment yourself. Creativity clicks in a way that grips the ground because it's combined feeling and knowledge put to action. You see, the same thing in many contexts. I was very impressed with a description by some researchers out of the medical school who were teaching HIV/AIDS educational information programs through children's theater. How would they do it? Well, they gathered kids together and they took them through a process that ultimately had them creating skits relating to HIV/AIDS issues and then performing the skits in theater groups for audiences of parents and neighbors. And the skits that the kids did had tons of internal family stuff with abuse and beatings and screamings and fights. And the experience was at once of good theater, which the parents would really come to, just the way you go to your kids' play, with the parents looking on, seeing the kids acting like adults very badly, that is, acting well as actors, but badly as people, with parents looking on saying, this is what we're teaching our kids, and the kids putting out an AIDS message, which was effective to the audience, but even more effective to the kids themselves, who form a cohort, who kind of come to understand at a level where they have friends to support them in the environment, that there are ways to behave that are self-respecting and self-protective. When you ask what the process is by which this theater strategy is organized, once again, you see the same stages. Step one, they get the kids together. Purpose of first meetings, just to establish trust. After trust, they do the three hats, more or less. They basically play games in which kids are led to see from the other point of view. And first it comes through conceptually, they get the idea. And then as they play, they get the reality of it. And then they have the kids engage in ways that have them talking with each other, literally interviewing each other, where the objective and the result is development of mutual understandings. And once you have that, you can move to the next level where you start to aggregate, bring it together, and then as a group together of trusting people who've expressed themselves to other people in the group and been responded to by others in the group, they work together as a group to see what they want to do. That's when they create their skit. That's when they write the show. That's when they learn to act it. But you can see in that same structure the progression. So where are we? Well, first, we are a class in discourse. It's like that's what we are studying. We are doing it and studying the structure of it. It's by its nature the kind of thing that when you're seeing its structure, it somehow draws you out of doing it. When you're doing it, you feel great and you're in it. But nonetheless, it's very good to stop and see where you are as you're going along and perhaps what the significance is of what you're doing. So I was so pleased with yesterday. I went home, and as soon as Democracy had it up, I watched it all again. I genuinely loved it. Now, I don't know. How about you? How did you people feel about yesterday? I don't mean to damp you down by telling you that I like it so that you can't, nothing else permitted. Yeah. Pass back. Tell me who you are.
I'm Josh. And I just thought it was a really fruitful debate, and they really, I thought it was informative for us, and they really explored some of the issues in depth, and I think it was definitely one of our best classes, in my opinion.
Yeah, I liked it for, well, I liked it in Habermasian terms, because at the point where you, well, let me do some more philosophy, okay? I've got up here on the board Charles Fried, Modern Liberty. Charles was celebrated last Thursday night for the publication of this at an event in the Ames courtroom, at which I had the pleasure of speaking, and then at a dinner following, at which Richard Parker, who was not able to attend the panel in the Ames courtroom, came to dinner and said what he would have said, and I recorded it. So I have it here on my blog. I'm going to play it for you in just a moment. But first, to just back up a bit. The first chapter of Modern Liberty was the first assignment, reading assignment, for Cyber One. Essentially, what Charles argues is for an individual orientation to liberty. It's a libertarian argument that he's making. His project is to regenerate respectable liberalism. He distinguishes liberty into two kinds. One he calls the liberty of the ancients, and he distinguishes that from the liberty of the moderns. The liberty of the ancients is based on the idea that a tribe, a people, a state should be able to rule itself, that you shouldn't be ruled by an outsider. This is a powerful idea. This is the idea which sets up the state as the important point of origin for rights and welfare. Charles points out that this is the idea which has built the pyramids, built the canals, but that it's also the idea that is in back of Hitler and Pol Pot. This is the idea of the state supreme and the individual as a unit to serve the state. And within that environment, if there's something left over for individuality, fine, well and good, but it comes second. This is Sparta. This is not Athens. To be compared with the liberty of the modern, as Charles puts it, his family, threatened by Hitler, fled Hungary, left, crossed the border. The liberty of the modern, as he sees it, is the ability of the individual to pick up and leave, choose his state. The idea is that each individual, each one of us, is in some pre-right, pre-state entitlement, justified in seeking to live the best life according to what we ourselves think. It's like it's our life. We should live it to the best. Now, what's best is up to each individual. But Charles takes that thesis and extends it to the idea that we choose our beliefs, we choose our understandings, we choose our biases, we choose the boundaries of our identity to a very great extent. And that we should be responsible for our choices. So, my excitement about modern liberty is that I see it as a philosophy that makes sense for the net. In a sense, the net is not what Charles was talking about. He starts his book by saying, since the 60s, I've been troubled, I've been thinking about the relationship of individual to state. Let's put it more concretely, his relationship to the social welfare state he inhabits, namely the United States of America. And I feel that that's where I've been too. And all that Charles says, and this came out at the discussion in the evening in parts that I didn't record, all that Charles says, in a sense, speaks to the expectations of an individual before you reach the point of statehood. So you can almost think of it as the framers coming together, ideally being the libertarian individuals that Charles is speaking of, who then join as self-respecting, other-respecting people, each of whom owns identity, coming together and forming a state. Now, when you think about that in the context of the United States or any state of the past, you see the easy metaphor of the Constitutional Convention. When you think of it in cyber terms, what is the social welfare state of cyber? I don't think it yet exists. I think we are in a pre-state environment, a network in which individuals can connect in a multiplicity of ways. And each of us steps up to the net as a person with the liberty of the modern. All right, so now here's Richard Parker's take. The panel discussion in Ames Courtroom was interesting to me in one particular respect. This included Lawrence Summers, former president of Harvard, in his first public appearance within Harvard since he stepped down as president, which was interesting and noteworthy in itself, introduced by Charles Ogletree, also speaking Martha Minow, John Hansen, Frank Michelman, Michael Boudin, Chief Judge of the First Federal Circuit, Robert Cordy, Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, and Richard Fallon. Everyone who spoke in the Ames Courtroom spoke from the vantage of the policymaker. Summers, the most explicit. Charles had written in a way in which, for example, the building of the pyramids was seen not from the point of view of the pharaoh, but from the point of view of the slave who dragged the stones, from the individual's point of view. Not a single person in the evening panel spoke from the individual point of view. All from the point of view of, well, how does this philosophy bear on how we make policy? And to my mind, each one, by doing so, missed his point, missed his personality and his expression of it in the direct way that he intended. But then Richard comes through at dinner. I hope this comes off nicely.
The book is not about the concept of liberty, as I understand it.
Wait.
And I think conceptual discussion is misguided. Of the book, it's about the spirit of liberty. And so what interests me is the spirit.
I'm getting it out of here. Oh, wait a minute. The plug is coming.
I'm
sorry? This is a dinner with clanking plates, and the sound is not necessarily the best, but you have to appreciate this for the content.
And I think that's what's exemplary about it, and that's what's missing, drastically missing, in the world that some of us in legal academia live in now. So I just want to say a few words about three things: the temperament behind the book, the genre of the book, and the style of the book. As Charles and I have known each other for quite some time. And I've told him before, there's a good Charles and a bad Charles. This book was written by the bad Charles, and that's why it's a good book. The good Charles, or the good person, I don't know if you... is someone who's well-behaved, who's sound, who keeps their contributions to conversations within appropriate bounds, who's cooperative, who tries to be coherent. And most... writing, academic writing by people who are good is bad. Desperately bad. To be bad, the bad Charles, the oppositional Charles, the obnoxious Charles, the irritated Charles, the person who rubs you the wrong way, okay? So he starts his book out with the three challenges, the choice of those three examples. I thought, when I read those, that's what gripped me. I read, this is the Charles I like to read. Not the one that believes in laws or whatever, as you said it was in that Texas, incredible Texas article. Some reason unfolding itself or something like that. This is the conflictual Charles. The Charles that talks about Pol Pot at the drop of a hat. So that's number one, the temperament. It means that it's an interesting writing, unlike most writing about law. Secondly, the genre. What struck me here is, and Charles says this at the beginning and then more elaborately at the end, he's not trying to demonstrate anything. He's not trying to prove anything. As you put it more extremely, you're not trying to force anything on us. You quote Bob Nozick on this point. He's not, God knows, presenting data and data points like so many of these people who pretend to be lawyers in academia now. He's not claiming philosophically that there's a correct interpretation of anything, that there are even entailments of anything. Now, he slips at a couple of points. He says, there is a fact of the matter about some moral thing. That's the good, i.e. bad, Charles, at work. That is evidence of a blight that I think is destroying legal writing now by compared to legal writing 50 years ago. But the main 99% of the book is not that. 99% of the book is the opposite. It's open texture. It's constantly moving. It's provocative. It's suggestive. There's no closure taken in the rest of the book. So this discussion we had earlier about, which is just basically a closure discussion, what's your concept, what's your policy, that's the dead type of discussion. That's not what Charles is doing in the book. The earlier discussion, in my view, was irrelevant to the book, therefore. This is a work that is far more open than I think some of you are giving it credit for in genre. Finally, style. many of us in the room, but not obviously everybody, read some legal academic writing. It is, I think, we know in our hearts, a wasteland now. The boredom induced. And that's why it's read by almost no one. Legal academic writing is read by almost no one, as we all know. But the boredom, if you actually read it, is just overwhelming. Partly because of its pomposity and the rest, but partly because of its pretense to impersonality. So what I love about this book is that it's personal. It's personal at every level. At some points it's explicitly personal. Charles refers to his family, for example, both his parents and his wife and his children. But it's also personal in all kinds of other ways. The style is pungent, it's humorous, and above all, it's light. At every moment, this book is light on its feet. You never have the feeling that you're dying when you read this book, the way you do most of the black things. My pitch to you is that this book exemplifies the spirit of freedom that he's advocating, and that's why I think this is, as Elena said, your best work.
All right, so just think about what Richard's saying. He's saying that this work is, in some sense, rhetorically exquisite. It integrates idea and expression. It represents in the way it expresses the very thought that it's trying to communicate. And so, in Aristotelian terms, you have the logic coming through to you. At the same time, you have the vibe coming through to you, along with the little tickle that just makes it fun. And that makes it really good. All right, so come back to yesterday. Here were these two people talking about a subject at which I don't know how many hours I've spent in conferences where people talked past each other about that subject. They, each one of them, know the arguments like a first-year law student at the end of the year can whip out distinctions. But each one came forward initially in a way that I thought genuinely demonstrated their humanity, at least enough for the other to see it. And when they actually turned and spoke to each other, it was a rational conversation. It had the elements of civility to it, in which when you take a position, you give a reason. And you're open to response on the reason. And so I felt that in the terms we're talking about this morning, there was some initial trust that built up. There was some exploration of seeing from the other point of view. There was some development of an area, at least where the possibility existed of common understanding. And then they actually started engaging in the creative enterprise of formulating thoughts about action. When Mike Frickless left, what he was saying to me is, Viacom would do something with this. If there was a project that somehow were to generate out of this, in which the objective was to, as he put it, monetize the long tail, create an environment in which a user like Wayne, with the choice of purchasing a license or not, might actually make the choice to choose in a way that was legal as opposed to dangerous and possibly legal or not, with the burden of demonstration, the risk that Rebecca was talking about. So that's what I liked about the conversation. It had this trajectory. It had some forward motion to it. Now, I'd love you to react. Josh.
There was one thing that Michael Frickless said, and it was really just one line, but I thought it was interesting, and I'd hoped that they might explore it further, but they moved off it pretty quickly. But at one point, Michael Frickless said, well, I can see from this mash that you've done, you put a lot of effort into it and a lot of talent into it, and you wouldn't want someone else to be able to take credit for it or to be able to use it or exploit it in some way that you didn't agree with. And, you know, the answer was, well, yes, of course. And then they kind of moved on. But I thought that was kind of the beginning of an empathic style of argument where he's asking, well, in the position of someone with a potentially valuable copyright and a work you really care about, what would you do? What law, you know, what protections would you have for yourself? And if you want to make a living out of doing this, what, you know, how would you want this to be protected and exploited, rather than looking at it from the perspective of there are these huge record companies who are controlling all this content and all of us poor folks can't get at it. If you had a piece of it, how would you want to protect it and use it? And they didn't go into it that deeply, but I thought it would be interesting to see what the response was if he had to make up the laws.
Where's the other mic? We've got two of them? Oh, good. But before you go, I've been listening to your podcasts, right? And the podcasts that I listened to that had to do with laptops in the classroom have had a real impact on me. Now, I don't know how many of you have listened to one of the podcasts that involved the laptop argument. I don't know. Well, here's the idea. The basic idea is that the old-fashioned classroom is a professor and student. That's it. We relate face-to-face, you and me. The only distraction is a piece of paper in front of you and you can write. And even that is an intrusion. I remember a story that I always liked. There was a guy, wasn't my property teacher, but this A. James Kasner, does that name still ring in the mythology of Harvard Law School? He was like a little tyrant who taught property. And he taught in the middle room at Langdell with a nice raised dais and big amphitheater classroom, and he'd walk around on this thing. He was always bothered by a kid that sat right in the middle who never took a note. And it just bugged him, because everybody else writing notes, and this kid would just always be just looking at him. He finally said to him about halfway through the year, he said, you're not taking any notes. And the kid said, who, me? He said, yes, you're not taking any notes. Why not? He says, oh, don't worry, sir, I have my father set. It's kind of like that. So, all right, then you take the classroom and you start to introduce technology. So now it's the teacher and the student and the laptop and solitaire. And then you put the net in the room. And then it's the teacher and the student and solitaire and email. And then you put a camera in the room. And then who knows what it is? All right, so what this podcast was doing, I thought very nicely, was it was on the one end of the spectrum identifying that some teachers, like Elizabeth Warren, really like just you, just me, close the laptops. And then there are other teachers who are into experimenting with the space and are delighted to have laptops and cameras and everything else. And what the wisdom was that I think was being offered is that each faculty member, in a sense, has the opportunity to be responsible and cognizant of the rhetorical space that is being created. And in fact, some sense, the educational enterprise involves the management of rhetorical spaces, the creation, the structuring of them, the managing of them. And that some are more useful for some purposes and others for other. And so I was convinced out of it that there would be times in this class when it would really be a plus if we all closed our laptops and it was just somehow more focused on the exchange. And so I was thinking, well, this would be a good time to do it. So if somebody wants to take notes for the week's page, okay, keep your laptop open. But otherwise, I'd appreciate it if you would close your laptops. Juanita.
I thought that it was so much easier to build empathy when you move from the big picture to the small personal argument that involves emotions also. I think when Rebecca intervened with, like, you know, we also want to make money out of it, it just gave, like, another layer of understanding that really it's easier to build empathy. And I think most of the arguments are always held at a very macro, ideological, rational level that it's very difficult to understand, like, the whole picture. So I thought
it's
that
like
was very useful.
It's like people having a policy argument right. up here, as opposed to people having a communicative argument, person to person, down here. Absolutely. Absolutely. Where's the mic?
I think what Josh was saying is right on. In terms of not actually getting a statement from Wayne about what the vision could be of somebody who's an artist who actually wants to make some money but isn't really necessarily looking for the big company deal. And that maybe didn't come across in the discussion that that's sort of what the monetizing the long tail is about in a certain sense. It's not just about somebody in Wayne's situation getting access to the materials that he would want as input, but having a situation where you have even more freedom than you have right now with the Creative Commons licenses to set the rights that you want to set on the things that you put out there. And currently, as a recording artist, if you get signed by a major label, the first thing that happens is all your rights go to that label. And then they manage them the way that they want to. And they manage them in a very tightly held way. And they manage the way that you become popular. That's a lot of the value that they add. But as an independent artist, one of your best strategies would be to not manage your rights in that same way. You might actually really want to put some effort into getting your stuff out there by making it available to people at a price that's reasonable for them and that gets you the popularity that you want to have in order to get, you know, build the fan base that you're interested in. So this sort of monetizing the long tail where you imagine the situation where you could put your music up and say how people can use it and how much you want them to pay for it is really appealing. It's like you go back to the individual and let them choose whichever way they think is the right strategy for them to go ahead and do it. And that system, at least technologically speaking, doesn't exactly exist at the moment, although what he actually does is, right now he gives away all of his music for free online, and he also sells CDs on CD Baby. That's something where he can set up his own price, and it's certainly not anytime soon going to be supporting us.
Well, yes, John.
We have a. I agree with your point. I think that was sort of the question that I was getting at yesterday when I asked him about what he envisioned the system to be. And I think it was also my point with the way the music industry currently works in that, I mean, not even with the record labels, just right away when you write a song, you compose a song, you sign a deal with a publisher, and you lose half your rights to the publisher for the musical composition, and then you lose the sound recording to the record label. So in the end, all you're getting is kickbacks from those two copyright owners. But I think that one of the things that was brought up in the Weeks page by a couple of the people was the way the internet has sort of changed that. So there were a couple of examples of fairly popular groups in the music scene right now that have gone their own way without label support and created their own network of a fan base and created profits that way, while maintaining control over the rights to their work. So one of the examples was Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, if anyone's heard of them. And they didn't have any label support. And then They Might Be Giants, I think, was the other example used on the Weeks page. And, I mean, those are just examples of how artists now, in an age where communication is more readily available in a wide network, can actually use the internet or something along those lines to really distribute in a way they couldn't before. So,
just to build on that, somebody actually mentioned South Park yesterday, and I feel like South Park is a good example of that outside the music context. South Park started off as this, you know, little internet cartoon that I don't know if any of you have seen, but it's the spirit of Christmas, and it's Jesus fights Santa Claus over the meaning of Christmas, and they have this sort of Mortal Kombat style battle to the death. And it's really, really funny. And, you know, that launch, they ultimately, I guess, they feel empathy for each other. And they find that they both bring something to the meaning of Christmas, and then somebody calls Cartman fat, and it sort of dissolves. But you know, I mean, so they had this internet cartoon that sort of made its way, you know, I guess, virally around the net and spun off into, you know, I think they're about to go into their 10th season at Comedy Central. They're in their 10th season, and these guys are loaded as a result of that. So I think it's a really sort of successful example of, you know, that use of a different medium to, you know, gain a little popularity. Then they got picked up by Comedy Central, and by that point, everybody already knew them, and they were sort of a built-in hit, and, you know, they got a lot of money now.
I was thinking about Dave Matthews Band and their tape trading on the web, which they've been doing for years. My friend was like a tape trader of Dave Matthews Band, and they started allowing people to record their shows. And live show trading became really, really huge. And I don't know, I think as a result, they became, for a time, one of the most popular touring bands. So I don't know. I think it's beneficial for everybody if artists are a little more open to that kind of thing.
Pass back to Christina.
I've read several things that have said that, except for, like, you know, your really, really mega pop stars like Britney Spears or whatever, actually most artists don't make most of their revenue from selling CDs. They make their money by selling swag on tours, going on tours, and stuff like that. So when it comes down to it, like, locking all of the music under, you know, really, really tight licensing is actually not the best way to benefit them, because if you do put your stuff online, what turns out is, like, it spreads more virally, and then you get more publicity, and then you get booked for more gigs, and you go on tours, and people are more willing to buy your stuff, so you actually end up earning more money. And I think a lot of bands are finding that out now, and there are some mechanisms, like, that are getting into place for it. Like, I think MySpace recently allowed bands to sell their music right off of their MySpace site. So it's, like, something that's definitely going to become a driving force in the near future, I think.
Yes, Aaron.
Something that we didn't even really talk about that much, that I think probably because we're, like, even taking it for granted at this point, although it wasn't this way, you know, 5 years ago, is that we've talked about, you know, the use of the internet and cyber media in distributing music. But we haven't talked as much about, you know, the use of this same technology in creating the music. The fact is that, you know, one of the things that record companies would, you know, used to be one of their resources, they can help you, like, get good recording facilities, and, you know, there's, like, a large financial investment to creating your music, whereas now, you know, home recording is so easy and, you know, so affordable, and that also using the internet, people can collaborate remotely on music. I think that's something on that end that, I mean, we're probably just taking it for granted now, is just my observation.
I thought there was impact in the room yesterday when Wayne had the music up in the graphic on the screen, so that suddenly you see the music and you see its relationships to the music, the mixing that he's doing. Somehow that tool is such an amazing instrument, and he plays it. But yes, it's just right there on the laptop. Yeah?
So the thing I got stuck on after class was this, maybe it's the same thing I was stuck on during class, but we basically got to a situation where both of the Viacom guys were saying, we would never sue you for what you're doing. What you're doing looks like it's totally fine. And it just doesn't match up to the reality of the situation from somebody in Wayne's shoes. Because what actually happens is he goes to publish a paper about this. Well, actually, this isn't happening to him, but happening to various people in his field. He goes to publish a paper on a university press, and the author sends a list of examples. Here's all the musical examples. Here's what I'm going to do for the transcriptions of them. Sends it to the publisher. The press sends it to the general counsel's office at the university. The general counsel's office sends it back, says, we don't have time to check all of these. Remove them. Doesn't even make the assessment of whether or not the fair use defense would be valid. They just don't want to go through the worry of it. And so even while the Viacom guys are saying, hey, this is really a clear case of fair use, and all that somebody's going to have to do is have a lawyer look through and say, oh, yeah, there's a clear one. We don't actually need the permission for that. We don't need the permission for that. Somebody's got to do the work. And what the press actually says to the authors is, you go do the work. You go get the permissions or figure this out. So there's this, like, legal transactional work that is actually preventing people from taking this, supposedly very minimal risk.
This is totally true. It's not just true with musicians. It's true with anybody who is publishing anything through a commercial publisher, because it just figures that the commercial publisher has a lawyer who has to worry about lawsuits, and given a choice of whether to do or not to do, the rule is, when in doubt, take it out. That's the safe thing to do, right? And the dynamic that's so difficult that Rebecca's talking about is the sending of a cease and desist letter is cheap. That's nothing. The responding to the cease and desist letter, that's a real expense. And for someone who isn't familiar with it, who gets a cease and desist and doesn't have anybody to talk to, it's really scary.
And people who are familiar. This is like a university. They just don't want to respond because they're going to have to pull that book from the shelves or what, who knows why. They just don't want to spend their money on the lawyer to do the work that it takes to assess it.
And I, as the would-be author dealing with the publisher who's telling me that I have to clear all the permissions for everything in my thing, I have two approaches. One is I can go through the ridiculous process of trying to figure out who it is and write them letters and how much they want for it and finding the money and paying it for every single one, or I can take it out.
But you can't say, hey, this is obviously a fair use.
You
I
can't
don't need
do
a
that.
Permission.
That's correct. You can't do it. It won't work. And that's the result of 100 years of the development of copyright law, which has put the procedural burden of going forward on the individual as opposed to the company. All the company has to do is send a notice, costless. Right? It's just the way it's been set up. And if one were looking for some element of the structure to change that would materially affect the whole field, it would be exactly that. It would be shifting the effective burden of going forward so that it actually cost the copyright owner something to assert the copyright. Yeah.
I think it's also kind of interesting, like, the double standards involved in the procedure. Like Wayne showed yesterday, it was very clear that Jay-Z, had sampled this Egyptian guy's song and without having paid any licensing fees for it or whatever, but then Viacom can turn around and sue other people for Jay-Z stuff or whoever owns Jay-Z stuff, I guess. And I thought that was very similar to actually a situation with Viacom a bit, I think, last month when all of Comedy Central clips were, like, deleted from YouTube, despite the fact that, like, both The Daily Show and The Colbert Report uses YouTube clips, like, in excess on their show. And, like, I mean, eventually they were put back up, but that just, like, raises the question, you know, like, so Viacom General Counsel can sit there and tell us that they never, you know, persecute for this kind of thing, but it's kind of clear that they do, and yet they also take advantage of it. So it's, like, this very strange situation. I just want to know what you guys think about it.
If I can just sort of piggyback on that, it seems like there's something, first of all, there's something a little nefarious about saying, oh, we never prosecute that stuff. You know, we would never accuse you of infringing, because they deliberately don't accuse you of infringing, because if it is possible, I mean, it keeps it unclear whether there's fair use or not. I mean, if there are lots of cases out there ruling, you know, this is fair use, then people are going to do it all the time and not have that sort of chilling effect of, oh, do I have to get permission and things like that. So, I mean, there's a way in which, you know, a certain amount of not pursuing it but leaving the potential threat there actually stops people from doing stuff. So that was the first thing I was going to say, and I've completely forgotten what the other one was.
Pass the mic over here.
One of the things that one of the attorneys of Viacom said yesterday that was interesting to me, and that I guess in a classroom setting we often forget, you know, he said, yes, you know, there's a world we live in, and then there's this other world that we would like to get to. But we have to remember how much it's going to cost to get from one to the other. And I think everyone would agree that it would be nice if we could have, you know, these, so that Wayne could publish these books. And I think Viacom would agree that the best situation would be if Wayne could take the lyrics and put them in there without any problem. But when you get back to it, you know, something we said earlier, everybody wants to make a living here. So you have to have some sort of legal regime set up to protect both people. And when you have that, there's going to be some, you know, rigid edges that you can't get around. And if you look at YouTube, for instance, with the South Park, I mean, YouTube did just sell their company for several billion dollars. And one of the reasons they made that much money was because people could get on YouTube and watch South Park. So how do you deal with that issue? And I don't know if there are any simple answers, but I think without some sort of transitional idea to go from one to the other.
Well, Frickless's eyes lit up at the idea of all of the copyrights, which are such small potatoes that they don't justify individual development, but yet nonetheless are worth more than nothing. That's what he sees as the copyrights that he talks about being in the basements, the long tail that is not monetized, the tremendous amount of material that is actually under copyright that requires everybody to go through this nonsense that nobody's really making money on. And his eyes are lighting up at the idea that if you could somehow generate a start that had enough go to it so there was really stuff available, that you might be able to start the engine. So he's, the way I saw it, he's like imagining Wayne. And he's, all right, Wayne starts out life, he hasn't got a nickel. He's a penniless musician. If he's got money, he's going to spend it on dog food to eat. That's like at the ultimate, you know. He's not about to hire a lawyer. And he's not about to pay somebody for permission for something he can download off the net. All right, then he goes along to a point where he starts making money, and some point comes where he might like to make a step into the legal world. At that point, it's probably a place at which he's got some revenue or some prospect of revenue, and if there were some easy legal way for him for a reasonable price to clear the stuff, he would go for it. Now, the existing system already has him as a violator. He's already in the soup and offers him no way to buy himself out except to settle with each individual opponent. But I think Frickless was imagining the possibility that there might be some net space that a kid could go to and see how much it would cost for him to go legal. And okay, it costs too much. I'm not going legal. I'm staying under the radar. Or, all right, I'm about to make the move. I'll go legal and it'll cost me a little money. So, okay. And the idea that seemed exciting to Frickless, I think, is that he was thinking he could talk to the people in his small world, which is very different than Wayne's small world. He could talk to people in his small world to encourage a whole bunch of stuff to go out of the basement into that kind of repository. So like Rebecca says, is he ready to take anything that Viacom happens to have control of, that they're not any longer making money of, and take it out of the basement and put it into the system? I think the answer would be yes. And I think he might find a whole bunch of other people to do it as well. So some kind of system in which we're not talking about taking the work itself and putting it anywhere. We're just talking about the license. All that would be being sold would be legality. And it would have to compete against the free market because you'd have a choice. Do I want to go legal or not? Some people would, some people wouldn't. And as Frickless has this deep faith in the market and the process of clearing prices after a while, he thinks it would come to some equilibrium point where people would kind of understand that's the way the system works. Seems plausible to me. Where's the flaw? Yeah.
They're not willing to give up on their control of the specific things. They care about who they're selling it to. So when it comes down to saying, are you just putting it out there and you're going to let anybody use it if they pay the price, I don't see that they're really willing to do that. That when it comes down to it, there's going to be some use of it where they don't like how it's being used and they want to be able to stop it.
This is your moral rights kind of a problem.
Yes.
Where I don't want the Democratic Party using my song or something like that.
Yeah, but it's not about the artist having the moral right. It's about the company exercising that kind of control, selective control.
All right. Well, I tell you what. Let's take a short break here to allow Tim to change the tape, and then we will continue right on.
They want to use their laptops within the class to learn. Fact remains that we are all tied to learning in a certain way, and the tools that we use should not be disruptive to learning, but rather should complement what we are used to. We personally are not in law school to learn how to take notes using pen and paper instead of a computer. We're just trying to learn what the law is, and if a computer is necessary to help us with that, then we should be allowed to use that computer to take our notes. Professors say that they should have the power to ban laptops because they feel people are not paying attention. But the problem should not be that students are not paying attention because of their laptops. It might be that the professors themselves do not have an interesting enough class. And it should be the professor's job as the teacher to come up with an interesting lesson plan that fully engages the students and the audience. Also, there's an inherent check in the system to make sure people are paying attention, at least to some degree, because everyone in law school has grades, and grades are important to what they can do in the future, and is the only test of what they do in the class. Therefore, students will pay attention because they know they have to have the grades to pass. If a student is able to make good arguments and learn the material in order to pass the grades, then it wouldn't seem that laptops are so much of a disruption in class because they're still getting the material and information they need and are able to pass the tests that are set up for them. We also now compete in a world where computers are very important and information is always at our fingertips, especially as lawyers. Lawyers need information quickly and efficiently, and we might even need to be able to search for information while doing other things. This means that being able to search information while in class and listening to a teacher and gathering new information is an important skill that we all must learn. Therefore, computers in the classroom can be a helpful tool, and students will be able to police themselves with the inherent checks that are already in the system.
All right, so what do you say? You persuaded? Microphones.
So it's interesting. I actually spent this summer teaching a class to younger kids, to ninth graders. But if there had been laptops allowed in that classroom, it would have been a total disaster. And I realize, you know, law students are different from ninth graders. We're older, we're more mature, at least in theory.
Everybody laughs.
These were some mature kids. I guess as a teacher, I didn't feel any empathy for my side. I felt like, I mean, I think there is absolutely, there are persuasive sort of legalistic arguments.
You mean listening to this, you as a teacher, you weren't feeling that this person was empathizing with you.
Yes, that's right. I can see absolutely the legal arguments that are made, and I think, you know, it makes sense, right? If you can, you know, play solitaire or Minesweeper or check your email or go Christmas shopping and still learn the material, then how much loss is really happening? I don't know. But as a teacher, knowing how difficult it is to construct a lesson plan, knowing how difficult it is to engage a classroom, and how much effort teachers, you know, hopefully and usually, I think, put into that, I felt like that was sort of dismissed by saying, well, you should just construct a better lesson plan. And I think laptops create such an enormous obstacle to that, that that was sort of glossed over.
All right. So now there's a challenge for you all. How would you go ahead?
I also thought that there was a student's argument that was missed in there, in the sense that if you're a student, you can choose whether or not to use your own laptop, but you can't choose whether other people are using laptops. And so if you're in a room full of people who are all on their laptops, maybe doing email or IM or whatever else they're doing, you not using a laptop may not substantially change your experience in the classroom. I mean, it's something that I've noticed personally because I'm joint degree at the business school. Business school, there are no laptops, no internet anywhere. And the classroom dynamic is very different. Everyone talks with each other. There's a lot more engagement in the average classroom. There are other differences, so I can't say it's only because of the laptop policy, but I do
think... They grade on class participation.
That too, yeah.
This is a big difference.
It is a big difference. It is a big difference, but the laptop, I don't know, I just think there's another element there to the student experience that is not purely about your individual choice.
It's definitely a good point. Definitely a good point, but it just puts me in mind of John Dayton from the business school explaining to me, I may have mentioned this to you, that we, speaking as the business school, have a multi-million dollar business in our cases. And for us doing the case method, if someone knows the answer before the case begins, it ruins it all. And so we stay as totally unplugged as we can. These cases are never put in bits in any way that can get out. So, yeah, we lock down the classrooms. No net, no laptops, no nothing. So, yes, it's got a Clay Christensen, yes, discourse quality and all that, but it's also got a nice big dollar sign down at the bottom of it.
I think there are a lot of reasons why the classroom is different, which is probably outside the purview of this course, but that might be one of them.
That might be one of them.
Yes. I also think maybe we're aggregating two issues which don't need to be, which is laptops and the internet, which are two different things that don't have to come and go together. I mean, you could argue that if we had, I mean, some people have their laptops out because they type very fast and they don't write so fast. And some people have them out because they want to check their email. And those are two different things. And if we just, if the classroom wasn't wired, not necessarily all of the problems of distractions of people playing solitaire and whatever might still be around, but I'd say that a significant chunk of it would be gone. And I think in addressing the question of laptops, it might be useful within the context of an argument in favor of keeping them around by showing that there are other alternatives to at least cutting away a large portion of the problem without getting rid of laptops altogether.
An argument that could cut both ways, however. As one could see an argument for getting rid of laptops until we had internet. But now that we have internet, there's something really useful you can do with them. The idea that you're wasting your time in class by typing fast. I mean, there was a kid in my first year class at Harvard, there was a kid who scared everybody in the class because he could type faster. This is like 1961. We're talking about the first IBM Selectrix, the first electric typewriters. This kid had an electric typewriter, and he would bring it into the exam. And they didn't have separate rooms then because not enough kids had typewriters. And he would start off almost within 3 minutes of the beginning of the exam, and it would be brrrr. It just was like utterly frightening. Straight C. Straight C. He became a very good plaintiff's lawyer. So I don't know, you know, talking to me, the idea of having the net so that you could actually download Scratch when it comes up or Google something or actually be in touch with the world outside and maybe even relate to the world outside, I could see that, not for everybody and not for every moment for anybody, but I could certainly see that it would be something very nice for a teacher to have available to suddenly have students in the class connected to the world, or disconnected. That is, this idea of playing with the rhetorical space and seeing what's good for what, and the idea that the teacher ought to be thinking about that and seeing the task as structuring the spaces, and of actually thinking that part of what we're teaching about discourse in cyberspace for lawyers is exactly that. That is, it's you're in a space, the teacher is structuring it. You create space, you structure it. It's like, that's it.
Just to respond, I mean, I completely agree. And this is, like, this is the only class that I bring my laptop to personally, just because this is the class where that sort of thing is.
You need to type really fast in here.
Well, no, I just think that we're going to be doing a lot of online stuff, a lot of downloading and Wikipediaing people that you're talking about. It seems more in the spirit of this class. But I think that he actually made that argument. I mean, that was really the point that he was making about that there's actual value to being wired. I just think that also, I mean, one thing that a lawyer does is they'll have an even if, right? Even if you find that we're wrong about that and that it turns out that the wired issue goes more in favor of getting rid of them on balance, you could sort of fall back to a lower position of, well, okay, even if ultimately whoever the judge of this argument is doesn't like the whole wired thing, you can do it. You can get rid of that without getting rid of laptops altogether. And so I guess it's almost a matter of defining what your issue is.
All right, we've got a few minutes left here. I want to introduce myself to you. I am Joe Average Teacher at Harvard Law School. I hate technology. I can remember the days when life was a lot simpler. I wrote my notes in longhand. I loved it. The time it took me to write them out was actually thought processing time. I still write anything important I do in longhand and then type it over. I don't like what technology is doing to my world or this world. I would just as soon keep it out. But there's nothing much you can do. You just have to go along with it best you can and harbor your resentments and keep them to yourself and watch these other yo-yos out there who are doing their Wikipedia thing. Talk to me. Empathize with me. How would you do it? Persuade me. You want to bring your laptops to class. At least you want to have the choice. Persuade me. Talk to me. Yeah.
Well, first of all, Professor Joe, this is 2006, and this is the world of technology and internet. So it's important for your students to be engaged in technology and for you as well. So.
Yeah, I know they always guilt trip me this thing. I mean, I feel like the thing I'm teaching the students is how to think about something. And the best way to teach them how to think about something is to just engage with them. And all this laptop stuff, and I'm supposed to feel guilty because I'm not teaching them how to do email or something. It's just, I don't know. But
so
you know,
I'll
just hide, you know, the administration, let them do what they want.
Is your issue that you think students are distracted? by their laptops?
I'm distracted. I tell you, I look up and I see all these laptops. I like to see faces. Instead, I see the kids down like this. They never look me in the eye.
That's understandable. But what you could do is, if you do have a very engaging lesson and you ask students to try to pay attention and try to stay off email, because you can have your laptop and not be on email all the time. And if you want them to look on the internet, you'll have access to that. For instance, if you're talking about a particular case and you want them to go and look it up.
I teach estates and trusts. It's not a big internet subject exactly. You don't need the net to figure out about a fee tail mail.
you don't.
Maybe you do.
But, but the thing is that you can use the net. You can use the net to explore other areas that you haven't thought of before. And even if you didn't have the net, laptops are very helpful.
I'm not feeling empathy.
But laptops are really helpful for students. And students will want to take your class if they can bring their laptops. Because there are a lot of students who will not take your class.
I hear empathy for students. I'm not hearing any empathy for me. I hear a lot of empathy for students. All how it's going to be good for students. All how it's going to be good for students.
What?
I'm the teacher in this class. I decide what's good for students. If I could, but this technology is actually destroying my life.
What I'm trying to say is, it doesn't have to destroy your life. You can embrace this and it can make you a happier person. And all your students will love you and you'll love them and you can connect.
Cole.
Mr. Professor, average professor. I understand that you want to prepare your students for the world, and you want to engage them, and you want to make them legal warriors, so to speak. But speaking from that perspective, we've pretty much reached a point where you might even have to reassess or redefine what thinking is in the modern area and the modern practice. You're gearing these young attorneys to be in these big, huge firms where you're carrying BlackBerries and on computers all the time. So the earlier they learn and know how to balance the technology and the old school aspects of the law, the better off they'll be in the long run. If we keep them defined to a much smaller landscape of just pad and pen and dictation, in a way, they'll be behind and they'll have to catch up.
I can see it is time for me to retire.
But we love you. We still want you to be around. You just got to work with us.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that, Mr. Average Professor, you know, as you said, what you want to teach students is how to think, right? You want to teach them how to think, you know, how to think like lawyers or whatever. And one of the downsides of a traditional way of doing things is that a lot of what you learn is not how to think, but it's just memorizing, you know, a lot of sort of details and a lot of facts and stuff, and that's really where you can see a benefit for computers, I think.
Yeah, but see, that's exactly the thing. Mm-hmm. I don't want to teach anybody how to memorize or
exactly, right? Exactly. You don't, right. And the computer.
So, but there
can
they are. They're all doing these things, and they get these outlines, and they regurgitate them back to me, and it's drivel.
Well,
it's not engaged thought. You know?
Oh, I understand that completely. I've been a teacher myself, but. And the point is, the computer is there to do the memorizing for the students, and then the interesting thinking can happen between you and the students in the classroom.
When they look up from their email, is that the?
Well, yeah. I mean, maybe what you do is you split up classes in an interesting way. You say, you know, some days I'm lecturing. Have your laptops. We'll, you know, you're just inputting data from, you know, I'm giving it to you. You write it down. Fine. We've got it. That data will be there for you to use on your exams later, whatever. Other days, or the second half of class, we'll close the laptops, and, you know, we can talk. You know, you're the professor. You can tell the students what to do, and they'll pretty much do it. You know, and that way, there's a sort of best of both worlds. The students don't spend the whole time trying to frantically scribble stuff down so that they have the information there. They get it quickly. And everybody gets the benefit of a kind of discourse that goes back and forth thinking about the information. Something like that.
Let's have Rebecca have a try here.
Excuse me.
So what I'm hearing from you is that the thing that's most important to you is that your students really engage in class and pay attention to what you're talking about and really think about the ideas with you. And one of the problems that you're coming up against is that as soon as you tell them, shut your laptops, take them out of here, do this class in a way that you as students don't want to do it, you take a big step back with them, where that used to be normal and it was okay with them. Now you've pissed them off right at the very outset when you've told them to shut their laptops. So perhaps you can find a way to start off with them where you really can make your point heard. You can say to them, this is what I want you to do. I want you to engage with me, and I hate these laptops. They get in the way. And so I'm going to ask you to either don't bring your laptop to class, or if you bring it, to bring it, but be very aware of whether you're engaging or not. And if you are not engaging, I'm going to tell you to shut it down. And don't imagine that, you know, we can't tell when you get absorbed into your laptop and stop paying attention in class. The beginning of that I was empathizing. Then I got off on it.
Well, first I would say that I agree with you in that laptops are very distracting, that they keep people from engaging in class a lot of the time, and they tend to be kind of a crutch because of whatever. We're just used to having them, and we're used to having just something kind of new flash across our field of vision every, you know, 2 to 2.5 seconds. But I think there's also a lot of legitimate reasons that students use them, and that's because, you know, we're graded, and we're all graded on a curve. And we don't want other people to have information and, you know, us be the only one not taking notes, and we come out of it knowing less than everybody, and that comes back to hurt us on the exam. So I think students might actually be receptive to a no laptops policy in the class, but I think you've got to meet them halfway in dealing with kind of the prisoner's dilemma involved and, you know, either make your own lecture notes available online or something like that so that students can engage in the class and not worry about, you know, the dictational aspect and not feel like they're hurting their grades and future prospects.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm thoroughly persuaded. All right. So a feedback memo. As always, five things. First one, big thought. What's your up feeling, if there is one? What's your up feeling about? Second, what's your biggest worry? What's your biggest concern? What's the biggest problem that you see looming, either with class, with individual, with nation, with whatever? Just third is talk directly to us. It's just like, hi, Charlie. Hi, Becca. Fourth is sign it or not as you please. And fifth, if you don't want it shared, do not share in big letters so that when I sort it, I don't make a mistake. The default is share. Well, I have to say, I think you did the best. I was listening to you. For one thing, you were talking to me in a way that felt like you were actually talking to me rather than arguing to me. And that was one of the things that I observed happen yesterday between these two guys. They actually started to talk to each other at some point. They got interested in each other. I felt myself actually get interested in what you were telling me. And it's like it just had a tone that was a little different than what I was hearing from others. And you were also inviting me to think in a way that had not necessarily just one side and I was going to be pushed to the other, but you were inviting me to think about the problem in a sense. I also was struck by the sense of I could be empowered that was coming from one of the earlier arguments. That was reaching me, some feeling that, oh, maybe I'm not just the weak, shy flower here that's got to retire. Maybe I could step up in some fashion that would be growth for me as opposed to doing something good for my students that I really don't think is good for them and all of that. So, yes, I felt there were empathic elements coming out, but that we would still have a good way to go.